title of this session, as it was given on the little bulletin board, said it had to do with sin and suffering. That was half of it. There's another part of it that we're going to be dealing with too, and I'll make that plain as we come to it. If anyone is interested in the hearing aid assistance that is provided, it's available in the Tate Ministries office right back here, and you're welcome to go and get that if you wish. Yesterday, the topic which I dealt with in my session had to do with faith and doubt as contrary terms, although I think we really didn't come to the conclusion that they are necessarily that contrasting. In a sense, today's topic, too, is a continuation of a concern with faith and doubt. Job, we are dealing with, that's not very good start for an English teacher, Job has great faith, and in the process of what happens to him, he comes to have great doubts, and he pleads for a chance to present his case to God and justify himself before God, and he is, of course, trying to recover the faith that once seemed so strong for him. One of the overriding ideas in the book of Job, I think, is this concern of a man who really has firmly believed that if he did his part and did what he believed God expected of him, then surely God would be fair with him and would care for him too. Now, the concerns that we have with Job are not exactly the same as we might be talking about if we were using this as a Bible study of the whole book, because I'm choosing out just a few things that I want to talk about. The topic on the bulletin board that talked about sin and suffering, but also the second that was not mentioned on the slip that had to do with the relationship between prosperity and righteousness. How do these terms get along with each other? How do they relate to each other? How are sin and suffering connected? Now, back at the time of Job, and I suspect in our time too, there are a great many who believe that there is a very necessary relationship between sin and suffering. When you sin, you suffer. It's that simple. I remember still with perturbation a student that I had some years ago who had spent so much time in and out of hospitals. And then she was in school long enough to go to a quarter, and she was in my Bible lit class. And she came to me after we had finished the study of Job, and she said, "You can't imagine how much the study of this book has meant to me." Well, I said, "Would you like to tell me about it?" And it turned out in all these months of hospitalization, she had had an aunt who faithfully came to visit her every month. And every time she came to visit her, told her, "If you would only repent of whatever sins it is that you have been doing, then God would heal you." What a terrible thing to say to a sick person, but you notice that person was believing that there is a necessary relationship. Now, I'm sure we know that there are times when there are relationships. There are kinds of behavior that bring about suffering. And there are sometimes relationships, but to imply that there's a necessary relationship in a particular instance is to take the work of God into our hands. There is this other idea that prosperity and righteousness had a necessary relationship. If a person were prosperous, that was a sign that he was righteous. If he was righteous, then certainly he would be prosperous. Now, that was a common idea in the ancient world, but you know, if you stop to think about it, how well can you verify that from your own experiential ideas? Have you noticed that the prosperous people you know are always the righteous. I don't think we'd get very far with trying to maintain that necessary relationship. Well, there are many different ways of looking at this particular book. The one that I have found useful is one that I'm going to use today in order to get a grasp on the story of the book. I'm going to deal with it as if it were a drama, an ancient drama out of the literature of the Hebrew people, and not a drama that has a lot of action. Most of what goes on is talking. There's a prologue that lets us know who the central character is, a man by the name of Job. And then there are some movements forward of the action that bring us eventually to the conclusion or the epilogue, where we find out how things went for that central character. You could organize or approach the book in a good many other ways, but this is the one that we're going to use today. And I'd like to just review the story for you a little bit in case you didn't read it just yesterday, and then try to identify some of the central questions of the book and see if we can put them together into something meaningful on these two questions of sin and suffering and righteousness and prosperity. The story begins with a prologue in which we are introduced to this man by the name of Job. And he gets quite an introduction. There aren't too many people, probably in all of biblical literature, who get the kind of introduction that Job does. There is a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. That's a brief, direct introduction, and you notice it's a very commendatory one. He has seven sons, three daughters, which in the culture of that time, no doubt, was a pretty good proportion. He has a great many possessions of sheep and camels and oxen and she-asses and servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. This is no ordinary person we're dealing with. And we're not told much about what he does in his life, but we are told a couple of very significant things. One thing that he used to do each day is to offer sacrifices for his sons and his daughters, who evidently like to party a little bit, and he is afraid, he doesn't seem to have any proof that he mentions, but he's afraid that when they get together, they might sin and curse God in their hearts. And day by day he performs these sacrifices for his sons and daughters. Incidentally, Job seems to have a thing about the idea of cursing God in their hearts and later on in his heart. Yeah, that's something he's afraid of. He talks seems to talk so much about it. That is the prologue, and then the action begins in the book of Job itself. And in that first scene, which happens, the first scene of Act 1, which happens up in heaven, you have God getting together with somebody who probably had thought wouldn't be there at all. Satan, the accuser, is the significance behind that name. And the sons of God come to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came among them. And God says to him, "Whence have you come?" And Satan says, "I'm going to and fro on the earth and walking up and down on it." And it's almost as though God can't resist the temptation to taunt Job, or to taunt Satan a little bit about what kind of a man Job is. Remember, there's a good deal of the thinking in this, the Old Testament, about good and evil struggling with each other in the form of God and Satan, God and evil struggling with each other. One wants to come out on top of the other, and it's almost here as though God is saying, "Satan, you haven't won yet, have you? You may have come a long ways, but you haven't won yet. There's my servant Job. Have you considered him? There is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil." That's quite a commendation. And it's a very strong one. You know, we're so used to thinking in terms of being told that all of us have some evil within us, that to have God saying to Satan that that Job is blameless and upright, that takes a little thinking about. However, Satan isn't perturbed by it at all. He says, well, why not? Haven't you put a hedge around him? Can anything evil get at him in the first place? You protected him so well. Well, it wasn't quite what God wanted to hear either, evidently. And so Satan suggests, put your hand out now and touch what he has. Now, it's not what he is here, but what he has, and he will curse you to thy face. Remember that's that thing Job was so worried about? And so God gives Satan permission to go ahead and to do to Job whatever he wishes as far as his possessions are concerned. And Satan goes forth from the presence of the Lord. And then you know how the story goes. There is a series of messengers that come to tell Job of some catastrophe that has happened either to his possessions or to his family. And by the end of that first chapter, in that scene that happens on earth in the locality of Job, Job has nothing left except his wife, probably the home place, because there is a scene in which things seem to happen. But Job takes it very well. Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Now this, remember, ties very directly with our question of how do righteousness and prosperity relate to each other. Job has lost his prosperity. Are we to understand that then as the word that Job is not a righteous man? That's not what God has said. And so we need to keep both of those possibilities in mind. Well, chapter 2, act 2, is patterned very much on act 1. Again, the scene begins in heaven with the same kind of interchange between God and Job. And God is proud of Job. He's really proud of the way Job came through. But Satan is not ready to give in yet either, and has his explanation for why it is that Job has come through so well. Skin for skin, he says in verse 4 of chapter 2. All that a man has he will give for his life, but put forth thy hand now and touch his flesh and his bone, and he will curse thee to thy face. And again, God gives Satan permission to go ahead. Satan does. Job develops a disease that some of those who look at the symptoms that are mentioned here have suggested is probably the Oriental disease of elephantiasis, a loathsome disease in many ways. And Job now is afflicted of that. He sits among in the ashes, scraping himself from this terrible itching. And his wife says, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. You know, so everybody is concerned with this curse God bit here, Job, Satan, the wife. And from here on, the wife disappears from the story until the very end again. Job has remained faithful. He says, shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Now, that's the setting for this. There are some very important things to notice here. Some people take this book as historical building of this particular story, and that is their privilege, but you know they're going to have an awful problem to deal with if that is what they do, because they're going to have that problem of what kind of a God are you talking about that plays cat and mouse like this with his children, with some of his most loyal children, or one of his most loyal children. So there is another approach to the story too, which is often that you have a story here that is told to tell, to teach a particular truth, and that is the cause of this. Incidentally, the story is back in the ancient Near East of those who tried to find a perfect human prince. Are rather numerous. They occur in Egypt, they occur in Babylonia, and in a good many of those literatures. There is this search. The Swahili Mohammedans, for instance, have a story of Michael and one of the other archangels who are searching for a perfect human being, and they find him in the form of a man by the name of Haris Chandra. It's not strange that this kind of story appears again and again, is it? Because it's into those eternal human questions that everybody asks. You know, how long can you live before you're asking some of Job's questions? Probably not very long. Well, there are a number of significant questions that rise out of this particular story. And one of them is already there in these first two chapters. And it's the question of, is the human being capable of disinterested goodness, or will he do only what is for his own self-interest? And the answer that God implies is that, yes, his follower Job is capable of this disinterested goodness. That doesn't mean uninterested now, but disinterested in the sense that it's not for his own advantage. Or does the human being act only for self-advantage? And the implication is no. Now, Job, we must notice here too, as we're getting into this, to keep in the back of our minds what God said about Job. Because there will be some things in the book that will make us think that Job is being pretty rash in what he says. And so we need to keep in mind how God evaluated him. Well, the next two questions we've already suggested that grow out of the story. Job loses his possessions, and there is the question, how are righteousness and prosperity related to each other? And the question, when he loses his health and his physical well-being, how are sin and misfortune, such as ill health, how do they go together as cause and consequence? Do they or don't they? So those questions are there. And of course, above and bridging both of those is that question of why do the innocent suffer? We can see why many people suffer because of things that they have done, or things that are present in society. We can have all kinds of reasons, but this whole question of why do the innocent suffer? Some of you, I'm sure, have read Albert Camus' novel, The Plague, and you may remember the priest who, when the bubonic plague has hit this city in North Africa, constantly preaches on Sunday morning, "This is here to teach you people to repent. If you will repent, then things will change." And he preaches that very harshly until one night he sits up with a small child dying from bubonic plague, and all of a sudden he doesn't have a sermon for the next morning. You know, how do you deal with the innocent suffering? And that's an important question in the book of Job. Well, now we meet some new characters, some additional characters in our story. We've only had three so far: God, Satan, and Job. And briefly we meet the wife. But now we have some of Job's friends coming on the scene. They've heard of what has happened to him, and they come from his own place. They make an appointment together to come to condole with him and comfort him. They don't even recognize him because of what has happened to him. They weep. They tear their robes, a traditional way of showing grief of the time. They sprinkle dust on their heads toward heaven, and they sit with him 7 days and 7 nights. You know, they're pretty good friends. the friends who will sit with you for 7 days and seven nights when something has gone wrong in your experience are well-meaning friends. And so long as they keep quiet, you know, they must have been wonderful friends for Job to comfort him. But, you know, so that's a long time to keep quiet, and pretty soon they begin talking. And they aren't half as much comfort once they begin to talk, until we have a particular meaning that we give to that phrase, Job's comforters. And it's no compliment to be called a Job's comforter. What do we really suggest by the term?
They're rubbing it in.
They're rubbing it in. It's your fault somehow, Job. What is it you've done? You know, obviously we're sorry for what happened to you, but somehow or other it's got to be your fault. And then begin three long cycles of debate between Job and his friends. Job, once he gets a chance to speak and they are willing to listen, and oh, how we need that sometimes when there is something we have to face. Job has the chance to say how he is feeling, and he does not curse God, but he does curse the day he was born. And his first speech is a sad complaint and a wish that he had died. If he had died, he says, the wicked cease from troubling after death, the weary are at rest, the prisoners are at ease together. The small and the great are there, and the slave is free from his master. Oh, he can think of so many good things about death. And Eliphaz, who seems to be kind of a philosopher, to judge from the way he talks, listens to this for just so long, and he responds. And Job answers him, and Bildad responds. And Job answers him, and Zophar responds. And then they start all over again in the second cycle of the debate. Now, if somebody constantly denies the validity of what you say, it doesn't take long until you get a little worked up, does it? And every cycle gets sharper, more sarcastic, more bitter, especially on the part of Job, but more angry also on the part of the friends. And some of the things that get said are pretty sharp. Eliphaz has listened to Job, and Job has claimed that it's not his fault that this has happened to him. We know that, because God has already voiced the answer to that question. In chapter 4, verse 7 and 8, Eliphaz says, think now who that was innocent ever perished, or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. Take that, Job. You know, what you're saying just doesn't mesh. Sin brings its consequences. And Job listens, and Eliphaz has a lot more to say. And Eliphaz goes on in the beginning of chapter 5 to say, surely vexation kills the fool, and jealousy slays the simple. I've seen the fool taking root, but suddenly I cursed his dwelling. His sons are far from safety. They are crushed in the gate, and there is no one to deliver them. My, they're tactful. Who has just lost all his children? Job has. And what kind of an illustration does Eliphaz draw in? Why, you know, the wicked even lose their children. The implication is a harsh one there. And Job finds it very easy to resent what is being said. Over in chapter 8, about verse 5, rather dim in here, so don't worry if you can't see it in your Bibles. I'll be reading a few of these aloud anyway. Bildad says, if you will seek God and make supplication to the Almighty, if you are pure and upright, remember that's just what God said Job was, Surely then he will rouse himself for you and reward you with a rightful habitation. And though your beginning was small, your latter days will be very great. You know, righteousness and prosperity will go together. So Bildad says. And Job flares back at him again. He says in chapter 9, verse 21, 22, especially 22, it is all one, therefore I say, he destroys, he that is God here, destroys both the blameless and the wicked. Doesn't make any difference. Whether you're evil or good, God will destroy both. And Job is finding it very hard to deal with these ideas. In chapter 10, verse 8, he says of God, thy hands fashioned and made me, and now thou dost turn about and destroy me. Remember that thou hast made me of clay, and wilt thou turn me to dust again? Didst thou not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese? Job may not have been a professional poet, but he does very well in his choice of language here. Zophar comes back in chapter 11, end of verse 6, says, know that God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves. Now, that wasn't what God said, was it? And Job thinks about his life and he says, chapter 12, verse 4, I'm a laughing stock to my friends. I who called upon God and he answered me, a just and blameless man, am a laughing stock. Later on he complains that his servants had no respect for him anymore. There evidently were some of them that were had left. And as far as he can see, verse 6, the tents of robbers are at peace, and those who provoke God are secure, who bring their God in their hand. But this kind of speech goes on, and we find the evidence that the debate is getting sharper. Chapter 15, verse 12, Eliphaz is saying, why does your heart carry you away, and why do your eyes flash, that you should turn your spirit against God and let such words go out of your mouth? What is man that he can be clean, or he that is born of a woman that he can be righteous? Behold, God puts no trust in his holy ones, and the heavens are not clean in his sight. How much less one who is abominable and corrupt, a man who drinks iniquity like water. That's strong language, directed very much at Job himself. And so it goes on. I'm not going to take time to read more of those, but they follow in the same train. Job can never get them persuaded that nothing that he has done justifies what has happened to him, and they can never get him persuaded that it isn't his fault that it all happened. And so there are other questions that begin to grow out of this as well. How about the justice of God? This comes to be one of the things debated. You know, the comforters have an easy answer. Well, of course God is just. And Job holds back from any definitive statement on that. But you can tell from some of the things that he is saying that he's not at all convinced in his experience that the justice of God is what is coming through. And then by the time one gets to the end of the story, and I'm jumping ahead of here just to include the last question, which gets to be that question when Job has gotten his answer. This whole question of, is faith something that you can have only when you have all the intellectual answers? Or is faith something that you have in the face of the lack of some of the intellectual answers? And that gets dealt with before the story is done too. One important thing more we should notice here, and that is for each of these three cycles of debate, Job reaffirms his faith. It's a shaking, tottering, angry faith. There's a new book that I haven't finished yet, but I'm a ways into it, and I'm delighted with the honesty of it. It's a book by Phil Yancey, one of the editors of Christianity Today, and the name of the book is Disappointment with God, and speaks very directly to those times in our lives when we are bitterly disappointed with God. And if you know people who are having that problem, it's, I think, a good book to recommend to them. I don't remember the publisher right now. But coming back to this idea that Job, in each of these rounds of debate, has a statement of faith. One of the things he says in the first one, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. And then a very Job-like answer to the conclusion to the verse, but I will maintain my ways before him. You know, he may slay me and I'll still trust him, but I'm still going to speak my peace. And that's evidently Job's nature. By the time the second debate has been on for a while, Job is beginning to wonder if maybe the answer that he seeks is not in this life, but in another one. In chapter 14, if you want to take a look at that, beginning with verse 7, and as these debates go along, you more and more get the idea that Job is just sort of forgetting those comforters. He's heard everything we've got to say now. And he's thinking to himself, there is hope for a tree if it be cut down, that it will sprout again, and that its shoots will not cease, though its root grow old in the earth and its stump die in the ground. Yet at the scent of water, it will bud and put forth branches like a young plant. But man dies and is laid low. And then skipping a little bit to verse 4. If a man die, shall he live again? All the days of my service I would wait till my release should come. Thou wouldst call and I would answer thee. Thou wouldst long for the work of thy hands. There is the statement of yearning faith for that second round. Maybe the answer comes later. And then in the third round of debate, there is another statement of faith that comes in chapter 19. Beginning with verse 25, he has just said, oh, he wishes he could write down his case and put it in a book and pass it along so that God could read it. Then he'd get an answer. Verse 25, for I know that my Redeemer lives, and at last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, then without my flesh, I shall see God, whom I shall see on my side. And my eyes shall behold, and not another. The word Redeemer that is used there in the Hebrew really means the word advocate. The one who will stand beside me and plead my case. I know that my advocate, my lawyer, lives, and eventually he will speak for him. It's a kind of a hint of grace, isn't it, that someday will be the answer. Well, when the story has gotten that far, there is an interruption. In chapters 32 through 37, by a man by the name of Elihu that nobody has ever said anything about before. Nobody pays any attention to him while he was there, and nobody ever refers to him after he's gone. And one of the reasons for that, many scholars assume, is that this is maybe a later addition into the story, so that Elihu is to say some of the things that writer would think had been left out. But Elihu has some good ideas. All of these comforters do at times. One of the things that Elihu says is that suffering helps us to mature. It's purgative. it helps us to grow. And then after he has said some very good things, he goes right back and says the same things over again that the other comforters have said. So we get the same thing repeated again and again.
What was the verse again?
The section of Elihu, chapters 32 through 37. And we aren't going to, we don't have time to go into them further here. But at the end of the speech of Elihu, there is another voice that breaks into the story, and it's called the voice out of the whirlwind. And this is some of the most magnificent nature poetry of all of literature. The voice of God breaks into the picture, and he doesn't give Job any answers. All he does is ask Job questions. You know, where were you when I created the world? You know, if you're so smart, why don't you come out with some of all of these answers? I'll have to admit that I don't find the God of the voice out of the whirlwind very likable. But because by now I have a tremendous sympathy for Job. And it seems that God is almost harassing him. Job listens, and it's interesting to notice, I think, that Job evidently doesn't react the way I'm doing. He doesn't express any dissatisfaction with God, but he does say in the break of that into two parts, if I can find where the break again in chapter 40, the very beginning of chapter 40, God says to Job, "Shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it." And Job, who has said a few chapters further back that if he could only get an audience before God, like a prince, I would come before him. All of a sudden, that Job, who is going to appear before God as a prince, is humble. "Behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer thee? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once, and I will not answer. I will proceed no further." And all of a sudden, the voice of God breaks in again with a whole long stretch of questions and statements about nature. And by the time the second one is ended, and Job's had it, he doesn't have anything more left to say. Chapter 42, he says to God, "I know that thou canst do all things, and that no purpose of thine can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge?" That's me. "Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. Hear, and I will speak. I will question you, and you declare to me. I had heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees thee. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." Job isn't a prince any longer appearing before God, but a creature before his creator, and accepting what he understands he has been told. Now, that's probably the most powerful section out of the story, but it's not all. In the ending, we want to look at that while we're there too, this kind of epilogue. I find it absolutely delightful. It's a very satisfying thing at the end of this very painful book. Now, God has talked to Job, and we don't know how Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar have been sitting there, whether they hear the voice of God or they don't, or what's with them. But verse 7 of chapter 42, "The Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has." This is an amazing statement. What has Job been saying about God? Well, he hasn't cursed him to his face, but he has really complained. He has complained in the strongest language he can come out with about how God has treated him and how unjust, how terrible all this has been. What have the comforters been saying? Why, how just God is. How Job should just, you know, keep quiet and listen and understand that certainly all of this was meant for his good. And now what does God say when he comes into the picture? He says, Job says about me the thing that was right, and his comforters have not. He's not done yet. He says to the Eliphaz, take 7 bulls and 7 rams and go to my servant Job and offer up for yourself a burnt offering, and my servant Job shall pray for you. My servant Job shall pray for you, for I will accept his prayer not to deal with you according to your folly, for you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. And these men are absolutely cowed, evidently. They go and get their offering, and they sacrifice their offerings, and Job prays for them, and the Lord accepts Job's prayers. These men have pretended to speak for God what they have not had their own knowledge and experience of verified. You know, people say, have you ever noticed, I'm sure you have, people say some terrible things to other people in times of grief. They say things that are anything but comforting. They pretend to know all the answers. Well, God needed your little one in heaven. Hogwash. You know, the human who pretends to know the answers of God almost always gets in trouble when he tries to pass them along to somebody else. Thornton Wilder, the American novelist, wrote a novel called The Bridge of San Luis Rey. And in that particular novel, there is a bridge that crashes while there are 6 people crossing it, and they are all killed. Off to the side stands a priest who decides within his own heart that he knows, he is sure, that for each of those 6 people, it was exactly the right moment for them to die. And so he goes to work and he does research to find out, he is quite sure, that yes, this was true. That for each of those 6 people, that was exactly the ideal moment for their death. And he reports to the authorities, the religious authorities, what he has found, and he is hanged as a heretic because he has claimed to know the ways of God with man beyond what any human being can do. That ties in, I think, a little with the story here. Now, has Job really been given an answer for what happened to him? No, he hasn't. There have been some good things said. There have been good things said by the other humans, and that voice out of the ruins section is certainly impressive. But Job has not been given an answer for why he lost his possessions, for why he lost his health, for why he lost his children. What has he been given?
Questions.
He's surely been given the questions, one after the other after the other. Anything else he's been given?
Reassurance.
You know,
kind
the,
of vague,
the one who's not expressing any dissatisfaction with what the answer he has been given is Job. Seems to me that we need to look to again at chapter 42, verse 5. I had heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees thee. He has had a vision of God that he would have not had without his suffering, and Job is not complaining. I think to really look at the whole issue, we need to understand, I think, that the definitive final answer for every instance of human suffering has never been given. We still wrestle with those questions in our own lives and in our own day. But for Job, he has had a vision of God, and he had yearned for that audience with God, and he has gotten what he asked. Is faith, in our last question, a matter of having the intellectual answers always present? No, it certainly isn't. If we look back at those questions again just briefly, is a human being capable of disinterested goodness? God is, has implied yes, because he has justified Job rather than the others. What is the relationship between righteousness and prosperity? Is there any necessary relationship? No. We know the poor who are holy, and the rich who are evil. And it isn't a case of whether they're poor or rich. There are other things that form that answer. Are sin and suffering necessarily related to each other? Not necessarily. Sometimes they may be. Sometimes it may be anything but that. Why do the innocent suffer? Well, we've been given some good partial answers, but we certainly haven't been given the final one. The justice of God? How about that one? Have we been given a definitive answer here about the justice of God? Seems to me that really what we've been told is that with our peanut brains, wonderful as they are, we cannot begin to understand the justice of God. And that it's presumptuous of us to assume that we can. And faith is more than a matter of intellectual answers. It's holding on until we get the vision of God that can come through our suffering. Well, this is one of the great masterpieces, certainly, of literature in general and of the Bible. At Rutgers University some years ago, they used to use the Book of Job as the basis for the whole one semester of freshman English. All the students wrote about was the Book of Job, and they discussed it, and they wrote poetry about it. They held a whole semester to this one work. And it is the kind of a book, I suspect, that can be heavy reading at times. Many of you know the writings of Gerhard Frost, I'm sure, and you may know his book, The Color of the Night, in which he uses the Book of Job in trying to comfort those who have gone through affliction. Now, I'd like to just introduce, I'm going to get to it. A work that is related to the Book of Job, and that is a play by the name of a writer by the name of Archibald MacLeish. The play is called J.B. Some of you may remember that Archibald MacLeish was Assistant Secretary of State in a part of the Roosevelt administration, the Franklin D. Roosevelt administration. He was also a writer, and is there anyone who has no access to a handout who would like one? There are a few more back on the chair there, and feel free to get them if you wish. But it's a play, J.B., you know, this looks suspiciously like Job. It's just got the vowel left out. And so J.B. really is to remind us of Job. And the play looks, many of you may have seen this performed, I suspect. It looks as though it might be a modernization of Job into the 20th century, and in a way it is, but in very significant ways it is not totally that either. The play happens in a circus tent, and in this circus tent there's a sort of a balcony off to the side where there are two broken down old actors who have masks that they are going to use in playing parts that are named Zus and Nichols. Well, you don't have to do a lot of work with Zus before you're into the word Zeus, and you suspect that it's the Greek god Zeus that has lent his name to this. And you play around a little bit with Nichols, and maybe you come up with Old Nick. What these two old actors are doing is to play the parts of God and Satan in chapters 1 and 2 and from there on. What they're there for, what they're going to put the masks on for, is to watch down on the stage of the circus tent. They're going to watch the play of Job acted out. And they talk with each other as they wait for the characters to come on. Nichols isn't very clear yet about who's going to play Job. And so he says Nichols says, I'm not going to be playing Job. What did you think of? Oh, Zus says, there's always someone playing Job. Nichols says, there must be thousands. What's that got to do with it? Thousands, not with camels either. Millions and millions of mankind burned, crushed, broken, mutilated, slaughtered. And for what? For thinking. For walking around the world in the wrong skin. The wrong shaped noses, eyelids. Sleeping the wrong night, wrong city. London, Dresden, Hiroshima. There never could have been so many suffered more for less. But where do I come in? And Zus doesn't know quite answer. He says, well, maybe you play in the dung heap. And Zus says, don't worry, Job will be here. Nichols says, I know, I've seen him. Job is everywhere we go, his children dead, his work for nothing, counting his losses, scraping his boils, discussing himself with his friends and positions, questioning everything, the times, the stars, his own soul, God's providence. What do I do? And so they debate. Well, the play begins, and down on the stage, J.B. and his wife and their children are seated at the Thanksgiving dinner. And J.B. is a little irritated by Sarah's insistence that they stop and say grace before the meal begins. And Sarah just keeps insisting on it. And she says, or implies, you know, J.B., sometimes I'm afraid you're not thankful enough for all that we have. Well, now if you want to look at the handout, she says to him in number one there, J.B. worries if he properly appreciates all that God has given him. And J.B. replies, you ought to think I do, even if no one else should, you should. Never since I learned to tell my shadow from my shirt, not once, not for a watch tick, have I doubted God was on my side, was good to me. This, we might like to reword that a little. Was he on God's side? You know, God was on my side, was good to me. People called it luck. It wasn't. I never thought so from the first fine silver dollar to the last controlling interest in some company I couldn't get and got. It isn't luck. Well, how is J.B. measuring the favor of God? How many shares he got in the company he had some trouble getting? And there's this dispute between husband and wife. As the play goes on, there come to be a series of messengers. There are two military men that come to the door to bring the news that their oldest son has been killed, not in battle, but after the battle by an officer who made a mistake. There is the first of the tragedies. The second, then there are photographers that come because they want to get pictures of them reacting to grief when they are told that two more of their children have been killed in a car accident. Or the accident was caused by a drunken driver. Everything has to be nonsense, you see, useless, meaningless. And then there is the news that comes also of how their little girl has been raped by a moron. And then comes the news of how JB's factory has been ruined in some kind of a nuclear holocaust which has just destroyed everything about them. And how does JB react at first? Just exactly the way Job does. But his wife reacts, or we're told more how she reacts. She leaves. She's had it. And JB sits trying to understand what has happened to him. And he says, as number two on the hand sheet gives you the quotation, when they ask him what he had done to deserve this, he says, "I have no choice but to be guilty. If we are innocent, God is unthinkable." Well, Job, or JB, keeps insisting. He's guilty. He's got to be guilty. There can be no other way than that he's guilty, because if he isn't, then God is unthinkable. He's trying to protect God's reputation by taking the guilt on himself. What happens in the story is that JB, unlike Job, loses his faith in a God of love. He says eventually, "He does not love, he is." And it's a different thing to admit there's a God who exists than to say there's also a God who loves. And JB can no longer say that. He doesn't any longer believe it. The comforters come in this particular story too. And they're a psychiatrist, a sociologist, and a clergyman. And they have all the pat answers of their fields. They talk about sin as a psychophenomenal situation or a sociological accident. And they aren't any more help to JB than the ones in Job were to Job. But one good thing happens to JB by the end of the play. Sarah comes back, his wife, and she's carrying a little sprig of a forsythia bush, which is the first sign that something could grow again after the nuclear holocaust. There can be life. And up on the balcony, Nichols says, "I won't stand for it. This man won't be willing to start over again, given the what's happened to him. He wouldn't think of it." And Nichols just gives up completely when he discovers that maybe JB will be willing to think of that. But here is Sarah, and she urges him to blow on the coal of the heart. It's all the light now. Blow on the coal of the heart. The candles in churches are out. And that's a very significant statement. There is no Christianity bringing her the answer there. The lights have gone out in the sky after the Holocaust. Too. Blow on the coal of the heart and we'll see by and by. Well, what Sarah is really suggesting is what Archibald MacLeish, the secular humanist, is suggesting. Because he, unlike the author of the Book of Job, is unwilling to accept the idea after these things have happened of a God of love either. And so the ending of JB is that essentially of an unbeliever in a Christian God or a Judeo-Christian God of faith and love. Well, the time is up, and I talked way too much and gave you too little to say. And I hope you keep talking about some of this amongst yourselves. I think we can profitably do some talking about that fourth question. what seems to be the contemporary religious attitude in America toward the relationship between righteousness and prosperity. You can listen to some television preachers that tell you that there's a pretty direct relationship, can't you? And that you can measure your righteousness by your prosperity, and that there is a necessary relationship between sin and suffering gets dinned into the ears of many people who need to hear mercy. But there are important issues, I think, here as we try to embrace these opposites and reconcile them with what happens in our own lives as we hold our treasures in earthen vessels. Thank you so much. I'm sorry I didn't give you a chance to talk to you.